The views expressed on this program are the views of the individual broadcaster and by no means reflect the view of Wesleyan University or the WESU management. Hello, and welcome to Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, a progressive-minded radio show about faith and action, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, and WESUFM.org, providing community radio that matters. I'm Maria Johnson. Today, I feel very fortunate that our guest is the renowned author Barbara Brown Taylor, who's shared her spiritual journey with us over the course of many books, including Leaving Church, A Memoir of Faith, An Altar in the World, and Learning to Walk in the Dark. Today, we'll explore her latest offering, Holy Envy, Finding God in the Faith of Others, in which she explores the world's great religions along with her college students in World Religion 101. As you'll hear, Barbara is wise, witty, and sensitive to the movings of the Spirit wherever the Spirit leads her. If you miss any of the episode or want to share it with friends, I'll post the podcast later this evening at reasonablycatholic.com. Back in a moment with Barbara Brown Taylor.
This weekend, unplug. Getting closer to nature can get you closer to your family. To find the forest nearest you, go to discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
I'm just a jealous girl. I'm just a jealous girl.
Welcome, Barbara Brown Taylor, Reverend, Professor, but mostly lifelong spiritual seeker.
True, and thank you very much for having me.
Well, no, thank you for especially this book, but all of your writing. I feel like you've been Jacob, in a way, wrestling with angels your whole life.
I was like a writer, I would have stopped by now.
Well, it's a very interesting question. Holy envy. It's so interesting. You see in other people's lawns, we'll say, spiritual lawns, that their grass is greener. And kind of intersecting with your teaching a college course, Religion 101, that covered all of the great religions, you were checking out the lawns, and you came to some interesting conclusions about that project, which feel very useful, speaking personally now, to me at this moment. And it's not about me, but I do find myself at a place where I'm just ready to be on what Reverend Rohr called the edge of the inside.
Right.
You know? So is there anything you want to say about your holy envy theme as we embark here?
I borrowed the phrase from Christer Stendahl, former dean of Harvard Divinity School, and when he said those two words together, he was bishop of the Church of Sweden in Stockholm, and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints was opening a new temple in Stockholm, and some of the locals were concerned about the strangers from Utah, and he was called to the microphone to address the unease. And he gave three rules for religious understanding. The first was, if you want to know about another religion, ask its adherents and not its enemies.
Yeah.
And second of all, don't compare your best to their worst.
Right.
And third, he said, leave room for holy envy. Mm. So he was the one who presented me with the phrase, which ended up being hugely helpful in a college religion class filled predominantly with Christians who loved going on field trips and loved learning about other traditions, but felt terribly guilty if they found anything they liked in those traditions, because in the teaching they'd received, that made them disloyal to their own tradition.
Yeah.
It made them disloyal to Jesus. So the phrase holy envy, as I developed it with them, was also a way for them to relax and take a breath and realize it did not make them disloyal to see something in another tradition's yard that they found beautiful or admirable.
Yes.
It didn't put theirs on the block for sale. They could be good neighbors.
And yet, not to interrupt, you discovered that the students did not just learn, but sometimes joined one of the other religions.
Very, very seldom. You know, over almost 20 years, I can think of two conversions to Judaism, serious conversions to Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
Quite frankly, and appropriately for college students, more often it resulted in a kind of agnosticism for a lot of them. When they discovered the wisdom in other traditions, and I presented the best and not the worst, I figured they got the worst in the news. But quite a few of them realized they didn't know as much about their own tradition as they thought, nor had they been presented with very good information about their religion's, should I say, competitors. That's the way they'd been often taught that.
Yes.
So if anything, a lot of them kind of went into a period of thoughtfulness about what religion was, where it came from, what it was for. And that seemed exactly right for late adolescents, early young adults to me.
Yes, and worth the price of their tuition, I would say.
Yeah, along with world literature, world music, and world history. I figured world religions belonged in their
Absolutely.
In their liberal arts education. And the college agreed. That's why they made World Religions 101 instead of Intro to the Bible, which was in place before I got there. So I was happy to take up that assignment.
Wow. It's tempting to fast forward to the end because you make some interesting discoveries, you know, at the end of the book. And by the way, I want to say, for such a slender book, I mean, it's less than 200 pages, you've crammed a ton of wisdom in there, you know? And it's not dense. It's very poetic and lovely and personal. It's completely captivating. And I just want to congratulate you. I know that you're a writer. You've written, you know, so many, many books and other kinds of writing. But this just feels like it's pulsing with useful information and things to ruminate on for a long time.
I'm happy to hear that. The book took a long time to write.
And I bet.
Several things happened in the writing of it. I had to step away from it for a while to take care of some family members who were ill, and came back, and I wanted to write a book just about the students and the world religions class, because I figured that's what most readers would be interested in, was a basic... This isn't a basic introduction to world religions, but it is a basic introduction to how beginners think about religions, their own and others.
Yes.
But I didn't decide to retire from teaching until the middle of that book. I didn't decide to talk about my own place in teaching world religions. You know, I'm a Christian ordained person, so that certainly there was plenty that I came to for myself.
Yeah.
But all that changed in the writing of the book. The editor asked for more of the teacher in the book, so I put more of the teacher in the book. After I decided to retire, that made a difference in how much I was willing to say about the teacher, because I wouldn't want any current students to read that book. They don't need to know that much about their teacher. And as you say, the last chapter, we'll leave it to the listeners to figure that out, but it was a complete surprise. I didn't know how to end the book, and then life gave me an ending to the book.
Oh, isn't it beautiful? That's so great. You know, you mention the way, we'll call them beginners, on the path, think about religions. And I even kind of typed into my notes here the kind of fallacy of the idea that, quote, your truth is good for you and mine is good for me, but how holy envy is another way forward.
Right. I discovered not only college students, but a lot of people want peace with one another as much as they can. And in the field of religion, you know, and probably the field of politics and the field of culture and a lot of other things, the easiest path to peace to a lot of people seems what's true for you is true for you, and what's true for me is true for me. But that ends up relativizing our searches for truth, trivializing them even.
Hmm.
So I did find that holy envy gave me a way to look at the really similarities between the world's great traditions, but also their irreconcilable differences, and to see that those differences were also full of wisdom. You know, where is deep disagreement about the nature of the divine? Where is deep disagreement about the human response to the divine. So those seem fruitful as well, but that's a next step that not a lot of people take in day-to-day life. It seems easier to just relativize.
Yeah, you know, it's coming to me now, and I'm probably not going to quote it correctly, but isn't there a Sufi saying about something like you over there and me over here, let's meet over there together.
Yeah, in the field, that's Rumi, in a field beyond right and wrong.
Yeah.
And since you bring that up, there was a separate course, you know, on mysticism, and it is interesting how the mystics, or if you'd like to call them the contemplatives, which seems to be a phrase that is easier on some ears across the traditions, could talk to one another, and even better yet, could be quiet together.
Right.
Out in that field beyond right and wrong, and enjoy some communion that wasn't possible while people were busy debating their understanding.
Right. And you say, maybe this is you talking poetically, that it's not that there are separate yards, but that we're drawing from a single reservoir.
Yeah, to swap metaphors. That's not, you know, mine alone, but certainly the idea that there is a great underground river, and that the religions are ways that we sink our wells, and they're not the same wells. They go through different earth, and they shape differently, and we fish stuff out of them differently.
Yeah.
They have their own locale, and yet to believe we have the only water on earth seems a little bit crazy.
Right.
To use that metaphor.
Right.
And a wonderful scholar of world religions named Raimundo Panikkar used the idea of the great rivers that run through the world. And they don't ever meet on earth, but he says they do meet in the heavens when the water in them condenses and comes back down to earth as rain.
That's so beautiful.
Another beautiful water metaphor.
Oh, my gosh.
That helps me think about what the traditions have in common and their distinctive differences.
Yeah, you know, I'm thinking of Joseph Campbell talking about all the ways to religion, the big R religion, you know, being like computers attached to a big mainframe.
Mm-hmm.
But I love that rain metaphor better.
Yeah, it's a little bit warmer than the computer metaphor.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I feel like because this is nominally, anyway, a Catholic radio show, it's called Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, and not to be negative about my own tribe, but you touched on something that has always driven me crazy, and that is whenever, quote-unquote, outsiders are at Mass, they have to get the little speech about who and who is not welcome to come up for Eucharist. And what I love is that you described how, you know, irritable this made you to the point where you stopped capitalizing the word church. Because really, there's all these just small c churches, and we're all, you know, doing our best to follow the teachings of Jesus, and there shouldn't be these kind of rules. So I just am bringing it up as a way of saying thank you.
Oh, well, and to rescue you and me both, the only traditions I think we can truly be critical of are our own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's a much better stance than to criticize the others and extol the virtues of our own. And I didn't so much, I think irritable is an interesting word, but I was damaged unexpectedly.
Yep.
Because what you're remembering is a passage about going to my uncle's funeral.
Yes.
In Texas, and I went completely theologically prepared. I mean, I do understand the reasons for closed communion. Missionary Baptist churches have closed communion.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot take communion in any church other than your own, because that's the only group of people who can hold you accountable, you know, for your inclusion of yourself in that Last Supper. Catholics, Orthodox Christians have different ways of talking about it, but I understood it intellectually.
Yeah.
So I went to the funeral knowing I would not speak, would not take part in communion, and what surprised me was how that came up from under my reason and under my understanding to a feeling of stinging exclusion. So that didn't go through my head at all. It went kind of came up through the pew into my body where I just wept as much for not being able to commune with him at that point as I did with losing him.
Right.
In the flesh. So.
Right.
So there's that. And it seems like a decent thing to claim. I mean, the Episcopal Church says all baptized Christians are welcome to communion. So guess what that says to everybody sitting there who's not baptized.
Right.
You know, it may be a broader invitation, but it still has a catch.
You know, and kind of relatedly, later in the book, you tell a story and you kind of end by questioning whether you did the right thing. And I just want to say, yes, you did the right thing. And that was when you declined communion because you were standing next to a Jew who was wounded by Christianity. Well, not to put too fine a point on it, you know. And you almost felt it would have been a kind of, what shall I say, betrayal of friendship or something, right?
To betrayal take of Jesus. Let's go right to the point.
Right?
Yeah, again, the context was a conference, and he was a modern Orthodox Jew who was there as an artist, a well-known New York artist, and I was there as a keynoter from Christian tradition, and the organizers arranged a Friday night worship service that went from a Shabbat service into a communion service.
Right.
The catch being, Christians, you know, could easily enter into the Shabbat piece, but for my friend, the Orthodox Jew, he could not easily enter into the communion piece because the blood of Christ held an entirely different meaning for him that was related to the blood of even the person for whom he was named, who had died in the Holocaust. So the blood of Christ had also cost a lot of Jewish blood, and he wasn't angry about that at all. If anything, he was apologetic, and he just said, I hope you understand why I can't take part in this. And again, it was a decision that came up, you know, from my body, not from my head down, when someone approached us with the bread and the wine, very kindly seeing us out on the edges of the group and brought us that. And at that moment, I had about a three-second crisis and just decided that my communion with him would be the communion for the night. So,
lovely.
Thank you.
Yes.
And they went back and handed it around.
And, you know, Jesus is fine with it, don't you think?
Yeah, I think you and I are perfectly equipped to reveal the mind of Christ. You know, and to me, I do think I learned that from Jesus, but it's also okay with me not to know what he would think. It seems like part of being an adult somehow, that you go ahead and do your best and don't pretend that it's what God wants and it's exactly what Jesus wanted. You know, it's my best hand. I'm playing the hand I've been dealt as best I can, but without the certainty that I'm right.
You're listening to an interview with spiritual guide and best-selling author Barbara Brown Taylor, author most recently of Holy Envy, Finding God in the Faith of Others. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, providing community radio that matters. Back in a moment with more.
Sure, humans can be a little weird at times, but take it from me, I'm a dog. And a person is about the best thing that can happen to a shelter pet. So if you want to learn how you can be that person, get down to your local pet shelter or visit theshelterpetproject.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
I did do a lot of work in the book for Christians who just didn't know where to look in Scripture because they get slammed so often with two or three predictable passages about Jesus being the only way to God. And so there are several chapters in the book that work with mostly Christian texts, but a couple of First Testament texts as well, to give Christians who wish, you know, to find some places in the tradition that come at multi-religious reality in a different way. I hope I gave them some resources for that.
Yes, absolutely. So many things to touch on related to all this. the word groupishness, for instance, you know, and how that's so problematic. And, you know, at one point toward the end, you say, why didn't I take them on a field trip to a girls' basketball game at a Muslim school? Mm-hmm. You know, that your definition of religion seems to be kind of broadening and broadening to include just everything, you know?
Yeah, and I learned that partly from Native Americans, whom I know people in the Lakota tradition who tell me there's no word for religion. Yeah. There is no word for religion in China when the Christian missionaries arrived. It was a way of life. It was a whole way of being. And what you're getting at in the book is I just started to realize that religion doesn't come in its own box. It comes with culture and history and foreign policy,
right,
and gender identity. And, you know, it comes in a big package, which is why I started wondering why I was sort of going from a classroom to religious centers to learn about religion, when the truth was those faiths were being lived out on the basketball court and around,
right,
the dinner table,
right,
and at school and in the neighborhood and at festivals. So that's part of what I woke up to writing the book, was the way in which I didn't want to compartmentalize religion in the way that the media often does,
yes,
in the way that every human being does, sort of organizing people, as you said, into groups, so that at very difficult times, our groupishness overtakes the best teachings of our groups about how to be with other people.
Right. You know, and since we are talking about our own tribe of Christians, you do kind of gently critique, especially evangelicals, for not being great listeners. And Christians...
Well, there are a ton of different evangelicals. You know, one thing, a lesson I took to heart was that how easily we reach for one word that describes all people in a group.
Right.
And that's another fallacy. You know, they're good grief. If we think all Christians belong to the same capital C church, take another look.
Right.
There isn't much we agree about in that. And in the same way, you know, I think Judaism, Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, Native American traditions are hugely diverse. And evangelical Christians are hugely diverse. I just came from practically a convention of post-evangelical Christians who,
huh,
you know, are deeply into LGBTQ inclusivity and social justice and wanting to make a difference in the world, which requires them to read Scripture in a different way and understand God and Jesus in a different way and to understand the mission that they're on in a different way. It shifts from bringing all people to Christ to believing that God means to heal the world with anybody who's willing to help.
Wow.
And that the group of people who step forward and say, here I am, may come in a whole lot of different flavors. But
so interesting. I had never heard of post-evangelical Christianity. This seems like progress to me.
Yeah, and I know people who say they are post-ecclesial Christians, which is another phrase I'm trying to get my head around, which is I haven't left the faith. You know, and the central commitments are right there, but I'm post-ecclesial. I'm not finding a way to act this out in my local congregation.
Oh.
And there's sadness in that. You know, the migration we're all familiar with from traditional institutions. But like this thing I went to with this crowd of 4,000 post-evangelicals, it's also wonderful to see the way the Spirit is bubbling up, you know, in new places.
Wow. Wow, I think you just handed me a title for where I'm at, this post-ecclesial thing.
Post-ecclesial?
Yeah, because I'm just...
And it's not anti-ecclesial,
no,
right? It's not
It might be
I'm
a little
anti.
Bit.
I want my Episcopal Church to be there just as long as it can be. I want it to be there for newcomers and children and visitors to town. So it's important to me that doesn't say anti. It's just...
Yeah.
There's some postness to a lot of Christian teaching right now that seems to me like a fruit of the Spirit. I'm going to go ahead and claim that.
Wow. Wow. I'm a little knocked off my pins with this. This is so interesting. I'm glad we're talking. Huh. I'm interested in talking now maybe a little about, without giving too much away, about the end of the book. Okay, you embarked on this asking for certainty, as you put it, and what you got instead were relationships. Talk a little about that.
Sure. I don't I guess like the students I was talking about earlier who came to a point of agnosticism, I at least came to a point of universalism, you know, of thinking perhaps it was time for me to get some distance on Christianity and see what it would be like to explore what, well, Joseph Campbell or Houston Smith called the perennial philosophy. I mean, I wondered what my relationship to Christianity would become as I began to learn more about the other traditions. So the end of the book is really, where did I land, and how did I come at least to resolution for now about my identity? And I don't think it gives away too much to say I decided that I come home at night to Christian tradition. For practical reasons, I'm too old to learn another one at any depth. I've barely learned the problems and beauties of my own, so there's not time to do much but admire,
right,
to admire what I see in the other yards. But so that was going on, but also a real recognition of how difficult it is to teach world religions in 15 weeks. To teach five major world religions in 15 weeks is to reduce each to a stereotype, even if it's a positive one. It's to reduce it down to a skeleton, which isn't true, really, of any individual or community of followers in the tradition. So there was seismic change for me in the writing of the book, both in relationship to teaching and in relationship to my own religious identity. The book was a journey, and I think any writer will tell you that where he or she meant to go is not where he or she ended up.
Mm-hmm. Although it might be the place where you began and you recognize it for the first time, like Eliot said, right?
Yeah, and I was just with Rabbi Rami Shapiro. He has a kind of chapter epigraph in the book. He says, we're all looking for the God of our understanding, but what we really need is the God just beyond our understanding. And he identifies strongly as Reformed Jew, but he is a lover of the world's many traditions. And he said something this week that I loved, and it was, how important it is to hold our identities lightly, you know, so that we can hold one another. Maybe now I'm going beyond what he said. So we can hold each other very seriously, you know, that we can hold each other well and respectfully and honorably. But sometimes when we're holding on to our groupishness, the word you used earlier, or our identities too tightly, it becomes too easy to exclude the people our religions call us to honor.
Yeah, you know, and you're landing in the faith that you embraced as a convert. It's interesting to me, you know, you say at one point, there's no spiritual Esperanto, you know, we have to speak the language we know, you know, and work with that language. And because you mentioned just a little bit ago about all of the other aspects of religion that kind of impact its little box, you know, culture, for instance, and so on. Do you think that's why it's so hard? I'm speaking of my own journey here. It's hard to embrace a different religion and kind of go deeply into it. Is it just too much in our bones to stick with the one we grew up with?
I surely do notice a lot of returning, reinventing, rethinking, and returning in people's lives. And honest to goodness, it's not just to a religious tradition. Sometimes it's to the places in the country where they grew up, you know, or to communities they knew when they were younger. But here's where I go. If the religion I choose to follow and practice, or the religion that chooses me, does not deliver me beyond my religion, if it doesn't know how to transcend itself and put me in the company of human beings whose religions have also taught them what it means to transcend those smaller boxes, then I have to wonder what it's for. You know, if it's just to recruit more members for a group. So let's talk about Esperanto. I think the spiritual Esperanto goes like this: belonging and love and sorrow and pain, sickness, and the wish to have purpose in life, the wish to know how to welcome the newborns and celebrate the partners and mourn the dead. Those are Esperanto. That's the human language. So what I love about the religious languages are the different ways that they parse that basic human language. And again, this seems deeply Christian to me. You know, they're at least embedded in the Christian teachings are things like, how can you love the God you've never seen if you can't love the brother or sister whom you do see?
Yeah.
You know, and when Jesus was asked for the great commandments, it was loving God and neighbor as the self. So if Christianity doesn't show me how to do that, how to transcend my own tradition, you know, in ways that keep me running back to touch the center, but running back out to the edges again where I meet other people at the edges of their traditions, I don't know, that just seems like the best to me.
Mm-hmm.
The absolute best my tradition can do is put me into community with other people who are human beings, who are finding their own languages and ways to be human in better and more whole ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at one point you say everything depends on friendliness. You know, it feels so true.
Yeah, and as you pointed out, sometimes we're harshest on the people who are in our own community.
Yeah.
Someone who read the book said, well, you disobeyed Stendhal's second rule because you showed the best of the other traditions and the worst of Christianity. I said,
Well, no, I disagree.
Then I had to fall back on, well, you know, mine is the only one. It's like your family, right?
Yes.
Who can you talk about but your own family?
So. Right.
And yeah, it does depend on friendliness, and it seems hugely important to me to remember to carry that home to my own crowd.
Right, right. Yeah, oh my gosh.
I mean, I can't, you know, say that I want to go to lunch with a Dalai Lama, but not with a member of my own community.
Yes, it's true. As annoying as our own community can be. You know, I had a lovely, elderly, now deceased priest friend who used to talk about, you know, living, he wasn't a monk, but he lived in a monastery, and he was often annoyed. We were friendly enough that he could share with me how annoyed he was with his brethren.
As they probably were with him.
Right, exactly. Oh, yes. And he would say, you know, people say, that old woman, they've never lived with old men, you know. And then I think it was Leonard Cohen who talked about the monks being like a bag of pebbles, you know, rolling around, bumping into each other and smoothing the edges off.
Mm, I love that.
Yeah. That's why they call him Leonard Cohen.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's where I just come back to the human. It's the value of religious communities, too, because In a lot of them, you don't get to choose, right?
It's
not a club. It's not there are initiation rites. There are probably things you can do to be kicked out. But the beauty of them is the neighbor is the neighbor. And with any luck, the neighbor does round off our sharp edges. Because while I'm always attentive to other people's sharp edges, I forget that I'm slicing them with mine.
Right. That's wonderful. You must be a writer. Not to change the subject abruptly, but I cast my eye on my list and I landed on Nicodemus. Mm-hmm. And I just want to celebrate how you redeemed him.
Thank you. I hope that Nicodemus, wherever he is, appreciates that. Because he's always made out. We're talking about a story from the third chapter of John's Gospel where a leader of the people comes to Jesus by night to ask him some questions, or at least to start a conversation, and he ends up being really just befuddled and ends up going back into the night knowing less than he knew when he came. But he's always made out, in the interpretations I hear, to be either in a very anti-Jewish way, you know, the Jew who didn't get it.
Yeah.
Since Jesus was Jewish, too, that doesn't make much sense to me.
Right.
But he certainly goes out as the people who just couldn't get his head around what Jesus was saying to him.
Yeah.
And my attempt to redeem him is, if you pay really close attention to what Jesus said, anybody who's born of the Spirit can't get their head around it. It comes, it goes, it blows where it wills, and that's the way it is. So that makes Nicodemus the hero of the story and not the person who didn't get it.
Right, because it seems like by your, you know, bringing this out, I'm understanding that Jesus was saying it's not you, just Nicodemus, you, but the nature of humanity that we don't get it, you know. Have I got that right?
Well, certainly. I mean, I think I did a careful look at John 3, and I don't think I flew off the page. I just had never noticed exactly what was on the page, that
yeah.
Jesus said, nobody knows.
Right.
And so Nicodemus's unknowing get settled down right there. I just never noticed that.
Yeah.
I always heard the passage preached somehow as Nicodemus should have known. But if you listen to what Jesus says, nobody knows how the Spirit operates. And I think he was talking about the Spirit there. So if people listening are Trinitarians, they can make something else out of the other two persons of the Trinity. But in that kind of teaching about the Spirit, that's the one you cannot get a lasso on.
Mm.
If you are just joining us, this is a visit with Barbara Brown Taylor, author of the 2006 memoir, Leaving Church. We're talking today about her latest book, Holy Envy, Finding God in the Faith of Others. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, providing community radio that matters. Back in a moment with more.
If you are undocumented and are detained by police or immigration enforcement agents, it is important to know your rights. In the event that police or immigration enforcement officers try to detain you, you have the right to ask to see an administrative warrant and to ask if you are free to go. If no administrative warrant is issued and presented to you, you have the right to remain silent and to not identify yourself or share any information regarding your immigration or citizenship status. Lying or giving false documents could result in legal consequences. If for any reason you are arrested, you still have the right to remain silent and to speak with a lawyer. For more information on legal resources, you can visit the Immigrant Legal Resource Center's website at www.irlc.org or call 415-255-9499. Again, that's 415-255-9499, or you can visit their website at www.irlc.org and click on the resource section for immigrants.
I was born to rock the boat. Some might sink, but we will float. Grab your coat, let's get out of here. You're my witness, I'm your mutineer.
And since we're talking about the Trinity, I also loved your take on it, which is that it's a way of saying unity is expressed in diversity. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, maybe we've got more than three. You know?
I like to think that. Yeah, I was always surprised to students in Religion 101 that the Hindu view of the Trinity is, that's wonderful. We believe exactly the same thing, that the divine manifests in many, many forms. Why'd you stop at three?
Yeah.
So that was always a surprise, that there was a whole other world tradition that completely believed in the incarnation of the divine.
Yes.
But just wondered why Christians stopped at three.
Yeah. You know, and it's so, it turns on its head my attitude about all of those strange gods. You know, the elephant god, the multi-armed god, you know. It's like, well, why not? Why shouldn't there be?
Yeah, I had a Swami explain that to me once, because, you know, a Hindu will tell you there are 33 million gods. And you say, oh, that's just ridiculous. That's hyperbole, you know,
yeah.
Like the Holy Spirit saying, just to blow your mind. And he said, no, in some Hindu understandings, any way the divine comes to people in dreams, in experience, mystically, straightforwardly, that is considered, you know, an incarnation or an emanation or a visitation of the divine. So he said, think about the population of India, easily 33 million.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So that was just one Swami's explanation, but I thought it was quite interesting that any way the divine comes to a person can be blessed.
Oh, gosh. I wish you lived next door and we could just have coffee all the time.
We never get anything else done.
I know, it's true. But, you know, that kind of brings me to something else in the book, which is kind of an exploration of why God made us so different from one another and how it was, to quote you, to slow us down.
Yeah, that was the work I did on the Tower of Babel
right.
story. making a lot of use of Jewish midrash, so I didn't work on that alone. But the idea, again, that somehow making us different was God's punishment, that's the way I'd always been taught the Tower of Babel story, that the different languages were God's punishment. But when I read the story, it nowhere says that. It's almost like God just changed God's mind the same way God did with the flood, which is a horrible story. You know, God just decided to start over again.
Yeah.
And Babel, in a way, is another way of seeing that. That God said, oh, it's not so great for everybody to be the same. Let's mix this up a little bit. There are now some wonderful children's books coming out that tell the story that way, so that children have a better way to understand what it is to be different. That's not God's punishment. That's God's blessing.
Ah, fantastic. I think the listeners can get, just from the way we're touching on so many different topics, how rich this book is. It's just a treasure, a literal treasure, like a treasury, you know? I put my hands together and bow, but I'm not done. So let me just, I should have done this at the outset, like a real reporter would have done. Terry Gross would have done this, but or Krista Tippett. But you're a convert to Christianity, but you started where before that?
I started with parents who had me pre-Vatican II, and I was born in 1951. So I was born then to a father who was raised Roman Catholic in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and a mother whose parents had not been, you know, closely allied with any Christian denomination, but sort of Methodist. And when my parents married and had me, they had me baptized really for my Catholic grandmother's sake. You know, I got my saint's name, Barbara, and I was baptized, but I was baptized in a pre-Vatican II church, which meant it was a very, very sidelined affair, you know, with a kind of hidden in a side chapel affair, because my mother did not become Catholic. And the minute she heard the priest talking about my sinfulness, she apparently took me back at the end of the service, looked at my father, and said, "We're leaving here, and we're never coming back again." That was their post-ecclesial beginning. So they didn't raise any of their daughters to be religious people, and if anything, thought that was a good thing to do. So, of course, when I became an adolescent, the only way to rebel was to get religion, so that was easy to do in the South. In high school, you know, with friends who went to church three times a week, Sunday morning, Sunday night, and Wednesday night. So I started going with them when I was 16 and became Baptist first time out. I didn't know there was any other kind of Christian. I thought that was the only kind there was. So I became a baptized by immersion sophomore in high school. And it went on from there to the point that the Episcopal priest who finally sponsored me for confirmation called me an ecclesiastical harlot because I had tried so many different religious traditions to find home.
I hope he was being cute and not serious.
Oh, he was.
Okay.
The loveliest man in the world. We both laughed heartily when he said that.
So, just for clarity, I'm sorry, I'm so ignorant of Methodists, but do they not believe in this concept of original sin?
Well, I think original sin, you know, if you go into it theologically, it makes a lot of sense. Every religion says we're out of whack, and there's some reason we're out of whack, or the world wouldn't look the way it does. So original sin is Christianity's way of talking about that out of whackness. But I don't think that filters down to a mother's mind when she's 23 and holding her firstborn in her arms.
Yep.
And it's the best thing she's ever done.
Right.
And instead she hears what a sinful bundle she's holding in her arms. So I think that was not a rational response. That was an instinctive one.
Yeah. You know, just thinking about you growing up, is this maybe overstating it, effectively with no religion until you and your high school friends found Jesus in high school or college.
That's good. That's good Protestant language you just said. Found Jesus. for all the Catholic and Protestant listeners, yes, that's what we call it down south. So go ahead.
Okay.
And for all that.
Well, I'm just wondering whether then you didn't feel some kinship with your students when they, some of them, had no religion and were kind of flailing around, figuring it out on their own, as you put it. And maybe that's why they were compelled to take your class. Did you see yourself in them?
Yeah, I think it's why I love teaching college so much, because I went on from my 16-year-old experience to a 19-year-old experience when I became a religion major in college, and then really did engage both intellectually and emotionally and every other way with Christian tradition. So I came alive in college in a way I hadn't come alive to a lot of things before then. So the college classroom was the perfect place for me, because it gave me a way to revisit that regularly, that wonder, the period of question asking and finding my own feet in the world, and to be around other people who were doing that was just a constant refreshment. So I don't have anything to compare my upbringing to, but I did find there are advantages and disadvantages, but an unspoken advantage was I didn't have a lot of preconceptions to be messed with. I mean, when I came to religion, I really came pretty blank, you know, and pretty impressionable, and pretty ready for fresh readings of things that other people had very rigid readings of. So there was an advantage as well as a disadvantage to coming to religion without a childhood background.
This is going to sound ridiculous as questions go, but you know, you take religion so seriously, and you're so, like you just described, you know, compelled by it, fascinated by it, made alive and by it. Even, you know, you worked through your what you call mid-faith ennui. So with all of its difficulties, I'm guessing, and like I said at the outset, never exhausted yourself in your interest in it. And I just kind of, it occurs to me that this, you probably have a community of like-minded friends and acquaintances and colleagues, but I'm thinking, because most people don't give a flying burrito about religion, you know, whether you don't feel a little lonely in your pursuit of it.
I think because I'm lucky enough to get invited places. In other words, I spend a lot of my time in tiny Clarksville, Georgia, population 1,500, but I'm regularly on the road to the Atlanta airport to go other places. And it means that I get invited to the most interesting communities of people.
Yeah.
And it, usually they won't invite me unless they're pretty out there themselves. So I really do get served the best. You know, the best of the best in terms of the people I'm around. But also, frankly, I mean, I don't have anything against tech people, you know, or people who are deeply invested in the automotive industry. And I'm not saying those are not people who are also interested in spirituality and religion. But the most interesting people I know hang around religious centers or spiritual centers,
yeah,
or are engaged in these basic questions of human meaning. You know, why are we here? What are we supposed to be doing? What happens after we die?
Yeah.
Who are we to each other? What's a purpose big enough, you know, for a human life? So I've never run out of people on the page or in person who are fascinating. I think some people can't give a flying burrito about religion. I like that, by the way, because they maybe have only, I don't know, they've been around communities that are tired.
Yeah.
Or they've just read the awful stuff in the newspaper that convinces them they don't want to go anywhere near any of that. So,
yeah.
Or maybe I've just been lucky.
Well, I think you just have more stamina than the average person, you know. I don't have to tell you, you know, it's not easy to be Catholic these days with the news always, you know, about.
Poor Methodists. The poor Methodists right now, you know, are struggling like other denominations before them with how inclusive they'll be of people who don't come in binary, you know,
yeah,
sexual identities.
Right.
So, yeah, it's hard to hang in with the institutions, and yet the institutions are how these traditions are communicated from generation to generation. So as much trouble as I may have with what I've heard some people call industrial Christianity, keeping the industry going with
yeah,
seminaries and schools and churches, that's how the tradition is communicated. And to go back to Nicodemus, thank goodness the Spirit keeps blowing through all those places and upsetting the furniture and changing things around, even when that means some of them have to die. I guess that's where one of the central messages of Christianity comes up and says, and after death comes life in a different form. And I hang on to that.
Oh, you are doing me so much good. You have no idea. I am at a place where I'm just taking a break. I just have to take a break from going to Mass, even just maybe doing this show. I feel I'm not really refreshed, to use your word, by it all. I'm really ready to step away. Maybe I'm having that, although it's not mid, but late faith ennui.
And I think it's painful. I mean, you've said several times you're speaking to me, and you're speaking to me right now, because I do feel oftentimes diminished when I go and listen to the language that you know my crowd traditionally uses in worship. I'm diminished by it, by the triumphalism in the hymns, by the somebody's got to die language in, you know, my precious liturgy. So it seems to me again like I'm just going to call it a work of the Spirit, that a lot of us are questioning what we've loved, what has sustained us.
Yes.
And I think it's worth us listening to ourselves and to each other about what it is we're missing. And if it's missing, doing what we can to create it, to bring it to the table, you know, even if we come sometimes with some belligerence saying, look, this has got to change. But like you, when there's no freshness in the water anymore, when it's not living water anymore, somebody's got to say so.
You know, without just hearing you say that is such a blessing to me. I really thank you. I do have one little quibble that I can't end our interview without bringing up, and that is, since you mentioned hymns, you ruined my favorite carol.
I'm so sorry. Which one was it?
You pointed out, you didn't give the title, but I know the lyric enough, how O Come Emmanuel, with its ransom captive Israel language, is so hurtful to the Jews. It's like, oh my gosh, I never realized.
Yeah, and I think a Jew could sing that in good faith, because, you know, the Jewish people are waiting for Messiah, you know, are waiting for Messiah to come. The catch is for Christians to say, yep, came and you missed him. So I, you know, I was talking to Rabbi Rami about that there are things he can talk about the corrupt Pharisees just fine.
Yeah.
But if I pick up that language, it's a whole different sound coming from my mouth. But that's, I certainly do talk about that. If there are any listeners who want to know more about that, that comes in a chapter called The Nearest Neighbors on teaching Judaism and how that brought up special challenges for me as a Christian because of the direct relationship between my religion and theirs, which are not, you know, as twinned as some Christians like to believe. When Christians talk about the Jewish Christian tradition, a lot of Jews go, not really.
Right. Yes, I interviewed a Reform rabbi recently who said, you know what, the Last Supper wasn't a Seder.
Right. That's absolutely right.
You know.
Yeah, and now you get into some toxic forms of holy envy, which are appropriation, assimilation, taking over other traditions. And the great ones do it. You know, Hinduism swallowed up Buddhism, and I think Christianity tried to swallow up Judaism, and so it happens. But that's true. And the appropriation of a Seder dinner by Christians who want to rework all the symbols to their own rightness and advantage is something to keep an eye on.
Well, it breaks my heart to say it, but we're out of time.
I have loved talking to you. You're the most careful reader in the world.
Oh.
I cannot thank you enough for reading this so carefully and asking such great questions. And for waiting for me to be here. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate your taking time out of your extremely busy life to do this. And thank you from the bottom of my heart. Keep writing, and thank you for everything.
Thank you, Maria. Send me the link when you're done, and
absolutely,
I'll post it on my website, okay?
Oh, wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was an interview with author Barbara Brown Taylor about her book, Holy Envy, Finding God in the Faith of Others. If you missed any of the episode, you can find it posted later this evening at reasonablycatholic.com. I'm Maria Johnson. Thanks for listening. Now stay tuned for the Jive at 5, followed by Wonderland with DJ Cheshire Cat.